Hello, I'm going to talk about the design of the primary data deduplication system in Windows Server 2012, which will ship in the fall. I am Sudipta Sengupta. I'll cover the first half of the talk, and then my colleague Adi Oltian will take over. Now, it has been difficult to do justice to all aspects of the system in a 12-page paper, and even I'll be able to cover even less in a 25-minute talk. So if you have any specific questions on aspects we don't cover here, hopefully we'll be able to address them towards the end. So we are focused on primary data deduplication, and that's a relatively recent trend in the storage systems area versus backup data dedupe, which has been around for almost a decade. And there are at least two driving forces for primary data dedupe. The huge 50% year-over-year growth in file-based data, and also it is the number one technology feature that enterprise customers are asking for in a storage solution. So there are a couple of unique technology challenges arising for primary data dedupe versus backup data dedupe. The most important is that one has to be able to continue to serve the primary workload from the same copy of the data. There is just one copy of the data. We're not talking about a primary copy and a backup copy. And the system also has to balance resource consumption, dedupe space savings in terms of actual storage space on disk, and also deduplication throughput, the rate at which you are processing the data to deduplicate it. These are some key requirements we identified for our primary data deduplication system. The first one is that we have to optimize for unique data, and that is because the bulk of the data is unique versus in a backup data dedupe system where 90% or more of the data is duplicate. Secondly, and this is kind of what I mentioned also in the previous slide, the solution has to be primary workload friendly. It has to maintain efficient access to the data for both sequential and random IOs, and deduplication cannot assume dedicated resources, and it must yield to the primary workload. And specifically in the context of Windows Server 2012, it must run on a broadly used platform. In particular, it must run well on a low-end server, and it should be able to accommodate huge variability between workloads and hardware platforms. So these are some of the requirements we started out with. Here are three categories of key design decisions that we had to make. The first one is around post-processing deduplication. So we don't deduplicate in line as the data is ingested into the system. You could do either that, or you could do dedupe as a post-processing workload, and that's what we do. Because we want to get the maximum dedupe space savings out of the system, and at the same time preserve the latency and throughput of primary data access. This also gives us flexibility in scheduling dedupe as background job on cold data, for example, and have a very flexible configuration of policies of when we want to dedupe, what type of data we want to dedupe, and so on. Now, for the next two categories of design decisions, these are driven by data set analysis. So let me quickly introduce the data sets we collected and analyzed. We analyzed about 7 terabytes of data spread across 15 globally distributed servers in a large enterprise. And we crawled this data and chunked it at different average chunk sizes using basic RAM, Rabin fingerprint-based variable size chunker. And for each chunk, we logged the metadata of the chunk. That's the SHA hash, the size, the compressed size, offset in file, and so on. And the five types of data sets are summarized in the table, and there is more information in the paper. So let me talk about some of the key design decisions around deduplication, granularity, and data chunking. So unlike some traditional backup dedupe systems, which use a relatively small chunk size of 4 kilobytes to 8 kilobytes, we use a fairly large chunk size of about 80 kilobytes. And of course, there's a spectrum of variation, but that's the average. We also have some modifications to the basic Rabin fingerprint-based chunker to achieve a more uniform chunk size distribution. How are we able to use a large chunk size? When you move from a small chunk size to a large one, from 4 kb to 64 kb, you obviously expect a loss in dedupe savings, and that's what we observed. But what turns out to be interesting is that if you now take compression into account and compress each unique chunk, that kind of compensates for the savings decrease with higher chunk size. And that's kind of expected because now you are doing compression over a larger chunk, so you might be able to get more savings in the shared dictionary. So that allows us to use a larger chunk size of about 64 kilobytes without sacrificing dedupe savings, but the huge benefit we get is we reduce the amount of chunk metadata in the system. Here is a slide about chunk reference count. So when you are designing a reduplication system, you might be tempted to deduplicate only the high ref count chunks. So here we have a chart where on the x-axis, we bin the unique chunks by their duplication count. So these bins are of powers of two sizes, and the unique chunks have ref count of one, and they are on the extreme right of the chart on the x-axis. And the y-axis, we have two sides. The bars correspond to the number of chunks in each bin, and the CDF corresponds to percentage of the duplicate space in terms of chunk count or chunk bytes. So what we find that the majority of the duplicate bytes reside in the middle portion of the distribution. So it's not in the extreme left of the distribution where you have the high ref count chunks. So it's not sufficient to dedupe just the high ref count chunks. So that points to the design decision of deduplicating all chunks that appear more than once. So unlike some other systems, it is an exact deduplication system. We don't use any chunk sampling. We do exact deduplication. Now, about the chunker, the standard technique is to use a Rabin fingerprint-based chunker. You compute a Rabin fingerprint-based hash on a sliding window of the data stream, and when your hash matches a pattern P, you declare a chunk boundary. So with that, your chunk size distribution looks roughly as what I've drawn here. There is a peak around the mean chunk size, because you cannot declare a chunk boundary before that. And there is a peak around a max chunk size, which is larger, somewhat larger. And in between, it is an exponentially decreasing distribution because the pattern match follows a geometric probability distribution. So you can see it is very skewed, and in many scenarios, it actually helps to have a more uniform chunk size distribution, especially for caching or when you consider data transfer over the network. There is another aspect here. At the max chunk size, you are actually declaring a forced chunk boundary. It's not based on the match pattern. So that is not content independent, and that could impact the dedupe savings. Okay? We always want to declare chunk boundaries in a content dependent manner triggered by the pattern match. So we address these two aspects in a regression chunking algorithm, and there are two goals. One is to obtain a more uniform chunk size distribution, and the second is to reduce forced chunk boundaries at maximum size. And our basic idea is very simple. So if you look at the match pattern P, that's the pattern P we are matching with the lower order bits of the sliding window hash. So you follow the original basic algorithm, but when the max chunk size is reached, you relax the match condition to some suffix of the bit pattern P. So what you're saying is you are willing to compromise on the full match, and you try to relax as few bits as possible, and you reduce the match condition by one bit at a time up to some configurable maximum. So we use, we relax up to k equal to 4 bits of the pattern, and you can show that for a random data chunk, the probability of a forced boundary at maximum chunk size reduces to 10 to the power of minus 14 with k equal to 4. So here are some numbers on how this technique helps. So the first chart is around how the chunk size distribution changes. The black bars and curves correspond to the basic Rabin fingerprint-based chunking, and the light gray bars correspond to the regression chunker. The first observation you will make is around the peak at 128 kilobytes on the extreme right, you will see a sharp decrease in the peak from the black to the gray. And that's how we have reduced the forced boundaries at maximum chunk size. And also you will notice in the middle portion of the distribution, it looks very, very uniform, the gray bars versus the black bars, which were exponentially decreasing. So that's about the uniform chunk size distribution. And the second part is the dedupe savings improvement. So for that, we took our GFS US data set and broke it up by file types, audio, video, PDF, and so on. And we saw that for some file types like PDF and VHD, the improvement in dedupe space savings is significant. And that can again be attributed to declaring more chunk boundaries in a content-dependent manner. Now let me move on to the third category of key design decisions. So we want to achieve the deduplication resource usage scaling. We wanted to the resources to grow slowly with data size. So for this, we take three different design decisions around three different dimensions. The first one I already talked about. By using a large chunk size, we are able to reduce the amount of chunk metadata in the system. Now, for a given data set size, we use a RAM frugal chunk hash index to reduce the RAM footprint of the index, and also to be more efficient in terms of disk I/O. So I'll talk about that, and then Adi will take over from the third technique, which is data partitioning. That's about partitioning a data set into smaller disjoint partitions so that each partition can be processed independently in terms of deduplication. So that's the overall schematic diagram for our chunk hash index. So it has some components. You will notice that the metadata on disk is organized in log structured manner, like in log structured file systems. So the insertions to the index are aggregated in a write buffer in RAM, and it is appended to the log in a single I/O. So this has two benefits. First of all, you amortize the writes to the index, and it also helps in prefetching in, for locality reasons, because the chunks in the log also appear in the order they were inserted into the index. So I'll come back to that in a moment. The third component is a low RAM footprint index. So we use a specialized hash table using a variant of cuckoo hashing that achieves 90% plus hash table utilization in terms of load factor. And the hash we are using in the actual system is a 32-byte SHA hash. So we don't store the full hash in the memory. That would be too expensive. So instead, we store a 2-byte compact signature of the hash and a 4-byte pointer to the chunk metadata record on the on-disk log. So we use just 6 bytes of RAM per index chunk in the system. So that's where the RAM frugality comes in. And we also have a prefetch cache where we prefetch chunk mappings for the next 100 to 1,000 chunks, and that exploits sequential predictability of chunk hash lookups, but it is expected to be less than in backup workloads. And for the prefetch cache size we use in the system, only about 1% of the index lookups actually hit disk. And note that that is not just a benefit of prefetching. For new chunks, when you look them up, your lookups also don't hit your hard disk because the hash table acts as a bloom filter for non-existent chunks. We don't need to use a separate bloom filter. So with that, I will hand over to Adi.
Hello, thank you, Sudipta. I'm going to move on the data partitioning technique. The needs for this technique is to because of the following observation. Even with an index that is 3 or 4 orders of magnitude smaller than the data size, the index can be still too big to fit in the RAM of Windows Server 2012. So for example, if you think of a server that has 10 terabytes of data, you still need about 1 gigabyte of RAM to hold the index, and this is way too much. So we can reduce the size of the index even further by partitioning the data in disjoint partitions and deduplicating each partition separately. Now, this is the first phase of duplication. The second phase is to reconcile those partitions by comparing the index across pairwise pairs of the index across those partitions. So the reconciliation algorithm is an iterative procedure which essentially takes the unreconciled partitions and pairs them with the reconciled partitions and does a one-to-one compare of an index of an unreconciled partition with an index of a reconciled partition. This operation is actually very, very fast. We typically use about 200 megabytes index size, which corresponds to about 200 gigabytes of data. So by loading two indexes in memory, you get about 400 megabytes memory consumption. Reading those indexes is very fast because you only use sequential I/O. So because of these two advantages combined, we can even afford in many cases to use the pure in-memory index. So when the actual index lookup is done in this index, we actually don't hit a disk. So the consequence is that we only use sequential I/O in the indexing process and the reconciliation process. Now, as you can see, for n partitions in a system, you're going to do order of n square comparisons over time. That's because the reconciliation goes in an incremental fashion. So after having n partitions and you add another one, you do n compare. So over time, you have a order of n square comparisons. This is still OK, given the fact that partition size is about a few hundred gigabytes. So this will accommodate easily a data set of around a dozen or even 100 terabytes. So, but going beyond that limit, we also employ techniques like selective reconciliation. So you can actually choose which of the two index pairs are going to contribute most to the duplication savings, and you can reduce that even further. So let's explore that a bit in the next slide. So let's assume that we can't perform a perfect reconciliation. We have to select which partitions to correlate. Which criteria do we use to group on this decision? One idea is to just do partition across files of similar file types. And because you're doing the duplication at the file level, we can look at the file extension and figure out which file extensions are related. And based on the study that we have in the table, it looks like the duplication by file type is actually very close in all the data sets that we have. It's very close to the global deduplication that can be achieved in that system. The other aspect which is interesting is that we can partition by file location. And that also gives some sort of hint of focusing only on certain partitions within a certain location. By that I mean either same system or the same volume or even subdirectories in the hierarchy. The assumption here is that the provisioning mechanisms that an administrator is typically using in a file server are correlated with the type of the data in that set of servers. So we have done the study of partition by file location, and we can see that even though the numbers are pretty significant, they are less efficient than partition by file type. In the end, we chose to have a partition by volume. So in Windows Server, we actually deduplicate every volume separately. And that all gives us some architectural advantages. So a quick presentation of the system overview. We have, as Sudita mentioned, we have a post-processing technique to deduplicate the data, and that is done using a number of deduplication jobs. On the left side, we have a filter which intercepts the I/O path. So the first consequence we can see is that the data path is independent than the duplication job, and they can happen in parallel. Finally, I want to mention that the storage layer is done by using a component called the chunk store, which stores all the chunks in the system, and it replaces the files in the file system namespace with file stubs or file reparse points using Windows terminology. So these file stubs are virtually pointing to the chunks in the chunk store in order to reconstruct the namespace the same way it was before. Finally, I want just to mention that there's a number of other background jobs for garbage collection, for reclaiming unused chunks, and also a fairly sophisticated data scrubbing algorithm which ensures that we don't lose, we detect corruptions in data or metadata which can be issued by hardware failures. Just as a quick presentation of how the data structures look like on disk. So on the left side of the pictures, you have the file system, the file metadata, which has a pointer to the chunks in the chunk store. So we have two key components, the stream, which is presented as a list of chunks, a list of chunk pointers, and each chunk pointer points to 60K around chunk size. Just to go quickly to the I/O path, how this actually works. The write path doesn't actually touch the chunk store. The write path actually is implemented entirely on top of the file system. So when a new write comes in, we try to do a partial recall and recall exactly the minimum amount of data from the chunk store in order to pad the new data to fixed size offsets. In order to do that, we use a technology in NTFS called sparse files. And because sparse files have to be aligned to fixed size blocks, we have to do a minimum on our recall. So on the bottom side, you see that on the left, this is the new data that was written in green. And on the right side, the data in chunk store remains untouched. The advantage of this is that the chunk store is read-only and is touched only by optimization processes. There's another aspect which is interesting when we look at dupe in the real world, which is the impact of compression. So compression can have fairly significant CPU impact. About 30% of the duplication effort in CPU is spent in the compression. So we use a smart technique of figuring out which chunks to compress and which chunks not to compress. And we based on that technique on the observation that we had on the real world data set, which shows us that 86% of the savings can be obtained only with 50% of the chunks. So, and beside that, 31% of the chunks do not compress at all. These numbers are specific to the GFS US data sets, one of the data sets presented by Sudita earlier. So the solution is to use heuristics to do a selective compression. And by that, we eliminate both the effort of compression during duplication, and we also relieve the CPU pressure during the read path. Beside that, we also use caching for the already decompressed data, so we don't we trade off memory for CPU. Really quickly, we are going to the performance evaluation. So in this slide, we can see that with a partitioning factor of 1 in the first two columns in the table, we achieve pretty much similar throughput of about 30 megabytes per second. And if we increase the partition factor by 3, meaning we are using reconciliation and partitioning, the speed of the duplication decreases only slower. So in the end, the duplication throughput is very, very light. We did that intentionally in order to not be intrusive in the actual system. And only a 10% decrease, you obtain only a 10% decrease by using this indexing technique. The most surprising results are in the index size. So for 3 terabyte data set, we actually use a 39 megabyte index size. And that's all we need for optimizing the whole system. Of course, with a speed of 30 megabytes per second. The CPU utilization is very low, is about 34 to 40% per core, so it's a very, very light CPU utilization, and that leaves enough room for the primary workloads in the file servers or other Windows-based servers. Finally, I just want to make a note that disk usage is very low. The median of the disk queue depth is zero because we are balancing between CPU and I/O. And at 75 percentile, the queue depth only increases by 2 or 3. So it's a very light impact on the I/O stack as well during the duplication. One last note on the performance. This design allows parallelization of several optimization duplication sessions in parallel. And we have also in the paper showcase that we can grow with one CPU per core. And so you can use one duplication session per core. And that allows us to linearly scale the throughput in the system. And finally, just to mention, we have workload scheduler, which is very careful in assigning jobs to cores and assigning RAM to each of the optimization jobs, so we don't have paging in the system. So just to close, this is a large scale, this feature started from a large scale study of primary data, 7 terabytes of data across 15 global distributed servers in a large enterprise. And this led to a number of decisions in a feature that is now shipping in Windows Server 2012. The feature is primary workload friendly and is also server friendly. It's a second class citizen in the server and allows us to perform constant duplication within the limits imposed by the OS with a very frugal RAM consumption and relatively low CPU consumption overall. There's a number of novel techniques for data chunking, chunking indexing, data partition reconciliation, and we also did a number of performance optimization by doing selective compression and caching in the read-write path. Just a final note, the primary data serving reliability and resiliency aspects are not covered in this paper. There's a lot more to this feature, but we only covered the stuff that I was talking about in the paper. Any questions? Okay.
Could you tell me a little bit about the crash recovery part? Because primary data recovery, the disk is quite cheap.
So this is a vast subject that we invested a lot of resources, which is totally not covered at all in the paper. I can just tell you informally that we did a very complete mathematical model of all the failure cases, and we ensure that. We ensure that in any possible crash, we are able to recover the data. So essentially, the customer has peace of mind that he can just enable this feature and he will not get corruption. Second, if there are corruptions in the hardware, in the disk, in the I/O path, or on the just bit flips on the bus, we are going to isolate that corruption and that corruption is not going to spread, especially given that fact that after the duplication, a number of chunks become hotspots. You have certain hot chunks which are replicated, which are encountered like thousands of times. And if one of these chunks is crashed, it becomes corrupted, then you may end up corrupting a lot of data. So there's a lot of effort invested here, but this is not in the scope of the paper. We hope to make that a subject of a future paper.
Okay. Any other questions? Now, let's thank the speaker again.